Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture by Massachusetts Middlesex County District Attorney Martha Coakley. A 1979 School of Law graduate, Coakley joined the Middlesex DA's office in 1986 as an assistant district attorney. 5 years later, she became chief of the Child Abuse Protection Unit, which handled the famous 1997 trial of British au pair Louise Woodward. She was elected Middlesex County District Attorney in 1999. Coakley's lecture is entitled, Media Coverage of Criminal Cases, What is the Responsibility of the Fourth Estate? We begin with an introduction by School of Law Dean ad interim Maureen O'Rourke.
Middlesex District Attorney Martha Coakley is a graduate of Boston University School of Law, and she's a seasoned prosecutor who has committed much of her legal career to the service of the public in Middlesex County and, by extension, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. She first joined the Middlesex District Attorney's Office in 1986 as an assistant district attorney in the Lowell District Court Office. In 1991, she was appointed the chief of the Child Abuse Prosecution Unit, and during her tenure as chief, she's investigated and prosecuted hundreds of cases, including the Commonwealth versus Louise Woodward, and of course, recently in the news, successfully prosecuted former priest Paul Shanley. During her term as district attorney, Ms. Coakley has earned the respect of law enforcement, the legal and medical communities, and really the public of the Commonwealth at large. And today, she's going to talk to us about media coverage of criminal cases. Finally, on a personal note, I have to admit that I really always wanted to be a prosecutor. But it didn't take me long once I got to law school to realize that I did not have what it takes. It takes a particular blend of courage, conviction, and compassion to speak on behalf of victims, many who can no longer speak for themselves, and to protect the public, which is at once both demanding and fickle, and at the same time treat defendants fairly and humanely. So I have a great deal of respect for the job that Martha does, and I also have a lot of admiration for the way in which she does it. So I am particularly honored to introduce one of our own alumni of whom we are very proud, Middlesex District Attorney Martha Coakley.
Last time I was up on this stage was 1978, and I was a very nervous second-year student about to give a moot court argument in front of, he wasn't the Chief Justice then, but Judge Rehnquist. I'm a little bit more relaxed today. And I am very happy to be here. In fact, it's an honor and privilege to talk about this topic. Just before we start, I suppose I should reveal that before I went to law school, I thought that I might become a reporter. I used to have arguments with a good friend of mine in my undergraduate school, Williams College, about whether we wanted to make the news or cover the news. She went off to Columbia School of Journalism, and I went off to Boston University School of Law. I have not regretted that choice. I love being a lawyer. I love being an advocate. And I should note that I have done defense work in the past. I believe that I could do it again. I feel very strongly about the need for a very well-funded and good adversarial system because that makes sure that prosecutors do their best work and do it well, and that people who are accused of crimes should get the best representation that we can afford them. But in the mix of that system, that of prosecution, defense, and how the court systems work, there is a very other real player that plays a very significant role in the way cases are viewed by the public, perhaps sometimes the outcome of those cases, for better or worse. But what I'm going to attempt to address today in somewhat of a broad view based on my experience, both as a prosecutor, as a consumer of news, but also someone who deals constantly with the media, is give you some of my observations about what a challenging area this is to make sure that we give defendants fair trials, that we make sure that our juries decide cases on the facts. But we also need, of course, to make sure, pursuant to the First Amendment, that people are informed, that they know about threats, that they know what has happened, and that both what prosecutors do and what courts do should not ever be done in secret so that we can evaluate that. A couple of quick anecdotes. I'll note that whenever we impanel a jury and we do special questions about how much publicity this case has gotten and how much a jury may have been, how much they may know about a case, I think we're always surprised to learn, and particularly media personnel are surprised to learn, that most people actually read and understand and hear a lot less than they think they do. And it is good news, bad news, but even in impaneling most recently, Commonwealth versus Paul Shanley, with the tremendous amount of pretrial publicity around the Archdiocese scandal in this Commonwealth, although much of that was beginning in 2002, had died down somewhat before we impaneled, there was our sense, and it was confirmed by comments of jurors later, that a lot of that had not stuck with them, that they were not, they knew vaguely about it, but they didn't have particular ideas about this case or that defendant. And I recall when I was in the process of impaneling Louise Woodward with my friend now and colleague Barry Scheck, he was quite concerned that some of the publicity about O.J. Simpson might affect the jurors' feelings about him or their opinions about them. I think he was somewhat disappointed to learn most of them in Massachusetts didn't know exactly who he was. The good news and bad news, again, as we look at what press and media do by way of coverage, I think we have to take it a little bit with a grain of salt, but I want to look at the way those three things intersect and what we need to be aware of all the time to make sure that we balance those interests, the First Amendment interest, the Sixth Amendment interest, and what I call the need for a level playing field for victims and witnesses. And so we will take a look initially at what your media intelligence quotient is. Now, about 3 or 4 years ago, and this was a phenomenon that I recall, and maybe you don't so much if you don't watch TV or pay attention, keeping in mind, of course, that there's just so much more coverage of everything than there used to be. Perhaps that makes a difference, too. There's such an overload of around-the-clock coverage by CNN and MSNBC and radio channels and news channels and now getting news on the Internet that in some ways a lot of what happens becomes a big blur to people, I think. In the past, if you were just reading the Boston Globe or the New York Times, some of the individual stories might have had a greater impact on you than they do when it's a constant 24-hour news cycle. And so you may remember that you'd see pictures over this particular period of time of a young girl, preteen or younger, blonde, darkish curls, who had been reported missing and either was suspected to have been murdered or was already been found dead. There was a spate of these, including Polly Kloss, JonBenet Ramsey, Sarah Pryor, Elizabeth Smart, Danielle Van Dam, Samantha Runyon. Sarah Pryor was in Massachusetts, in fact, in our county. It remains still an unsolved homicide. Elizabeth Smart was more recent, young girl who was returned to her home in Sandy, Utah. A couple of the others were in California, and, of course, JonBenet Ramsey, still unsolved in Colorado. JonBenet Ramsey had never been reported missing. That was the only distinction in that case because she was found at home. The last three were all in the news and, in fact, were probably the main reason why we had federal funding and a great push for Amber Alerts. I have nothing personal against the Amber Alert system. It's proved to be useful. But it was an enormously successful campaign by those people who were concerned about children being abducted, I think, as a result of many of these cases. And it was instituted across the country in what really responds to what I think, from my experience, is a very small percentage of child abuse. And yet, day in and day out, most of what we know is child abuse by people who know each other in the home, in the family, in foster homes, by trusted authority figures, as we'll talk about later, actually is very underfunded, is unrecognized. And so it's interesting that when a particular issue catches the public's attention because the media attention on it, you can mobilize the Congress of the United States, which is not so easy to do, to pass federal funding for something like an Amber Alert system across the country. When you heard about all these cases, and again, it may depend upon your age, your gender, where you are in the country, and whether you watch the Today Show in the morning or you pay attention to these shows or you're a fan of CSI, I suppose. People might have been horrified. Some of them kind of knew about it but have forgotten. Some might have felt guilty because you didn't really pay attention. And others said, you know, overload, I'm not going to worry about it. It doesn't affect me. Of course, across the country, you'd have found this range of reactions and more to that kind of media blitz around what we would all agree is the most horrific thing in some ways for a parent, to have a child abducted and then forever missing or found murdered, particularly when there's no resolution to it. It is certainly a story that catches headlines and catches people's attention. But what I want to do is look at a couple of cases and take a look at the media treatment of those cases and see what effect that had on how they were resolved and what the public perception was of those cases as they were investigated, as they came through trial, and actually post-trial. Why do certain cases, in fact, become the headline on the Today Show or are covered extensively by the New York Times, that they become so interesting, even if it's for a short period of time? And, of course, in the industry, a case that lasts probably for more than 2 or 3 days, like Michael Jackson, is a story that has legs. We deal with this all the time, and we've gotten a sense of, we have anywhere to 20 to 25 homicides in Middlesex County every year. We cover 25% of Massachusetts. It's a much lower homicide rate than in Boston, but we have had some high-profile cases. And we also have some that the media will give a short little paragraph to and never return to because it's of no interest. What is the short-term and long-term response by the way media covers a particular case? Does the coverage pass what I've termed sort of, for purposes of today, ethical reporting? And what, in fact, do we learn from that? Whether we're a consumer of news, we live in a community, we're in law enforcement, we're defense counsel, we're involved in criminal justice. Or for those of you who are budding lawyers in the audience, for the students who expect to practice, what does this tell you about your own obligations as an advocate when you become, as you will, pass the bar and become members of the law profession? In the last 30 years, the Lawyers Weekly had listed the 30 most memorable cases of the last 30 years in Massachusetts. Six of them were criminal cases in which I or my office had direct involvement. We're not looking at all of these today, but you all recall Woodward the Nanny case. We're going to take a brief look at that. Gerald Amrault, the Fells Acre case, certainly was a story that had legs for a long period of time. We are going to look at church sex abuse cases. That was in the top 10 stories. Jeffrey Curley, you may remember, was the young boy from Cambridge who several years ago was abducted and murdered and was probably the case that was closest to changing the death penalty in Massachusetts. It did not, but that was a time period where people were so outraged about that vicious murder of that young boy that they were one vote short of changing the way Massachusetts treats the death penalty. And finally, and we're not going to look at it today particularly, but Thomas Junton, also known as the hockey dad, an unusual set of circumstances. I can say that it's probably the only case in our office for all of those that we've covered, from the New York Times to national media to, in fact, in the Woodward case, international media. It's the only case where Sports Illustrated was interested in the outcome of that. Of course, this is common sense. What's going to catch the headlines? What's going to be a high-profile case? Murder, kidnapping, rape, all that violent kind of stuff usually gets people's attention. Exception, people aren't that interested in white-collar crime unless the money is a huge excessive amount, the number of victims is excessive, but still, for some reason, even though people were incredibly interested, for instance, in the number of priests in the archdiocese who had been involved in sex with children, when we indicted somebody, a priest on the was no longer in the county but had acted in the county for embezzling large amounts of money, nobody was interested in that. So go figure. But the things that seem to be the most important are the identity of the victim, the perpetrator, sometimes both, and also the relationship of the perpetrator to the victim. What is the trust that's been violated? What is the thing that makes this a story that's going to capture attention? We certainly know that we have a high crime rate in many of our urban areas. People are raped and killed, frankly, every day. And in some ways, it's old news. Whether that's good news or bad news, even bad news doesn't always get attention anymore unless it can be taken to the extreme of some other factors. What does the media have to think about, or what should they think about, in terms of the ethical coverage when they are approaching cases that involve individual suffering, cases that perhaps haven't been solved yet, public safety versus the defendant's right to make sure that he gets a fair trial? Well, I'm going to go through a quick list that is not exclusive. It is, first of all, beginning with accuracy. You know, first of all, it's not always possible, but certainly the news media should make sure that they use correct facts and that they put them in context. We all have heard spin. We know about spin. You can watch Fox News in the no-spin zone, and you can decide whether they are a no-spin zone or not. But everything comes in a context. And if a newspaper, which has a philosophy against a death penalty, they're going to perhaps cover different cases and cover them in a different way than a newspaper that's in favor of the death penalty. Tenacity is the second thing that you'd want in your reporters, that they know when a story is important enough and it requires additional effort personally and institutionally by that newspaper to make sure that the public gets the facts and they get them in an appropriate context. Dignity, something that seems to be less of concern these days with around-the-clock coverage and microphones in individuals' faces right after the tragedy has occurred, the interview the next morning with the family members looking shell-shocked off stage while the particular morning reporter says, well, how did you feel? It seems that very few things are beyond that these days, and we seem to have dropped this threshold for which we feel is acceptable coverage in terms of the dignity of individuals who are involved in criminal cases. We also look at the reciprocity. I think every once in a while newspapers and broadcast media, and I'm not saying they don't, but they should treat others as they'd want to be treated and put yourself in the shoes of someone who's being covered. Sufficiency on an institutional level, that there are adequate resources, and on a personal level, that they are as thorough as possible. And equity, probably not an issue that you, for first-year law students or second-year law students, you're probably thinking about Professor Rickman's class, right? But I'm really talking about seeking justice for all involved in controversial issues, treating all sources and subjects equally as they should be, and perhaps equity is the better term rather than equally, to make sure that there is a fair airing of the issues and the sides involved in this, that you can't just get a quote from one side and leave the story at that, particularly when you know there's another side and maybe a third side to that. So those are, there are a couple of other things, obviously, that the press we hope would look at, and I believe by and large they do, that they value community values, social cohesion, and they look at diversity, covering all segments of the audience fair and adequately. That, by the way, is a criticism that has been lodged consistently at the media. You recall my example at the beginning of the case, blonde girls who had curly hair and were cute who were kidnapped and abducted. And there was an outcry from minority communities, basically who said, look, our kids are kidnapped. We don't get this kind of coverage. What is that about? And there is a prejudice that's built in communities and perhaps by the media that cover it about what is newsworthy. That is an issue, and I'm certainly not picking on the media because all of us, whether we're in law enforcement or in the private sector or in the media, have to constantly check what our own prejudices are about how these things work. And so with a rough outline of some of the goals we would look for in media coverage, let's take a look at what our goal is as consumers, really briefly. If you're looking at the news and you're watching this, you clearly don't, you want to not overreact or underreact to these stories, but you need to think about them with a grain of salt and be able to take the lessons from them that will help us learn, change laws, change legislation, and make sure that we don't knee-jerk respond, but we respond in a thoughtful way if at all possible. From a law enforcement perspective, certainly from media coverage, what I think I look for, what I look for in our office is to make sure that we can apprehend and hold perpetrators accountable. So if there's a murder in Middlesex County, that is news. And if a murderer is at large and someone has been killed, the public's entitled to know that. We constantly deal with what is appropriate to disclose without either impairing the integrity of that investigation, endangering others who could be further victims, and making sure still that we abide by the rules set by the Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts, that statements not be unduly prejudicial, keeping in mind Sixth Amendment rights to a fair trial. We certainly have an obligation to keep the public advised of public safety threats and issues, as do the police, and so the media are extremely helpful in being able to do that. Their ability with television coverage and internet coverage to let a community know about a particular event that's occurred that might endanger others is a huge service that they do routinely and that we sometimes take for granted. I always make an effort if there has been a homicide in a neighborhood to specifically say at this stage we do not believe it is random because we often know that it appears to have been targeted violence or perhaps is domestic violence, but we don't believe that someone is going door to door and knocking on doors and killing people. And so for the neighborhood's point of view, I think we have an obligation to do that. Sometimes we don't know, and we will say that also. We can't tell whether it's random or not, so people should be careful. And we certainly think that alerting the public to crimes and the number of crimes and letting them know the results of them is a useful tool in preventing crimes in the future by way of education, by way of making changes. Again, sometimes we have a knee-jerk reaction to what we hear in the media, but oftentimes if there's enough of a problem. For instance, I think it's really important that people understand that OxyContin abuse is a huge problem in our communities in this Commonwealth. I understand that OxyContin is an important pain management tool, but it currently is abused, and people do not understand the extent to which it can be abused and which it is addictive. And until people are educated around that through the media, the numbers of children and others who use this drug will continue, and that is a public safety and a public health risk. From a media perspective, what are they trying to do? Of course, we know that the First Amendment and the need to get out all the news that's fit to print. They're trying to be accurate, they're trying to be timely, and they want to be newsworthy. They want to get the scoop. It's much harder to get the scoop these days because breaking news and into your internet program or your CNN program, there's no such thing really of anybody getting a scoop anymore. But keep in mind that media is also business. We understand that. They have to meet deadlines. They need to maintain and grow their readership or their viewing or listening audience. So they don't exist in an abstract. They have to sell advertising. They have to be realistic that in order to survive, they have to meet certain business principles. Okay, beating a dead horse. Case study number one, O.J. Simpson. This case, of course, meets all those criteria for why you would find a case that would be on the top of media's list. A story with legs, a story that wouldn't go away, and it was, of course, a murder. We had a multiracial situation. We had husband and wife. We had the kinds of celebrity aspects to this that seemed to be straightforward when the case first came out and yet took a turn over the way it was covered. Defense, of course, to my mind, was able to totally distract the jury from what the issue was here. Did O.J. Simpson kill his wife or not? Now, I'm not begrudging them the opportunity to do that. I think that because this case was seen so extensively, people watched it, that you could see that the judge really didn't have control of the courtroom, that the prosecutors had misunderstood how difficult or how aggressive a defense was going to be mounted. I think they took many things for granted which they shouldn't have, and you could see bit by bit that this case was unraveling right in front of your eyes, a sort of uncomfortable phenomenon. Good news and bad news, and I'd like to think that in the end this particular case was nothing more than that, that it didn't really stand for any proposition, it didn't teach us anything, it certainly didn't change anything about the way domestic violence cases were approached or prevented. We didn't change any laws. We really just looked at it as one of those sui generis spectacles. We know that domestic violence is a huge killer of women across the country. It's in many of those cases, most of those cases get nowhere near the kind of publicity this case did. And so although there was, I think, after that case, a nationwide sense of disillusionment and frustration about the criminal justice system, and I would try to say, but it's just one case. And in the end, we believe that if the prosecution cannot do its job and convince this jury beyond a reasonable doubt, then the defendant goes free. That's the price we pay for having a system where we believe that only the guilty should be convicted and that it is better for guilty people to go free than the reverse to be true. For the media, it was a new experience in some ways. Keep in mind that this case launched Court TV in a major way. This got viewership all over the country. People who probably had never had watched, like I did, Perry Mason and other kinds of trials, were seeing the real thing in real time. But it certainly did show the judge and prosecutors and the prosecutors underestimating the defense. And you could see, I think, ultimately, that the prosecution was just done in by this. Now, interestingly, in there are many states that still do not allow courtrooms, allow TV cameras in courtrooms. Florida was the first state to do it, I recall. And I remember the summer I was studying for the bar, I used to stay up late at night watching Ted Bundy defend himself. He was a law student. He was charged with several serial murders. I was fascinated by this. I guess it was before I even knew I was going to do criminal prosecution or defense work. But that was my first exposure to the real thing, and you can see why people get hooked on it, because it was real drama. It didn't happen in an hour, and you didn't know what the outcome was going to be. But it was a great boon for Court TV. There's no question about that. Massachusetts has been particularly friendly to Court TV. I've tried a bunch of cases where the camera's in the courtroom. People ask me, doesn't that make you nervous? And I say, well, I guess after a while you really forget about it, and you just make sure that your slip isn't hanging. One of my colleagues who tried a case that forever is being replayed on Court TV, I remind her, Sheila, you still get a guilty verdict, but your slip is still hanging in that trial. Let's look at case number two. May not be familiar to you, but it's an interesting example, I think, of how there was positive change as a result of media coverage of this case. I didn't think it was sensationalized in any way. It was a horrific case. Back in January of 2000 in Everett, there was a young woman in our county who found a package on her front porch. She walked upstairs, opened it up, and that's the last thing she did because it blew her and her apartment to bits. We charged eventually, after a difficult and long investigation, Stephen Caruso. He was ultimately convicted of that, and he was sentenced to life in prison. It was a circumstantial case. We thought immediately that he might be the perpetrator since he had already been convicted and sentenced for putting some kind of sugar or alcohol in her gas tank. He had stalked her from the time that when she first refused to go out with him when he used to sit at her counter in the restaurant where she worked. What was interesting about this case was that, and I recall at the press conference, somebody said, well, did the system fail Sandra Burfield? And I didn't really think about it, but I said, I guess so, because she's on the autopsy table. And it was one of those examples where she had tried to do everything. She got a civil restraining order against him because she wasn't, she could not get a 209 restraining order. She didn't have a prior relationship with him, so she wasn't eligible for a restraining order. She had set up a video camera herself so that ultimately he could be convicted of this stalking of her, but he was convinced. There was nothing that would stop him, it seems, by going after him. It was a particularly intractable set of circumstances for her. Her family, of course, was concerned about this, and like many families who suffer tragedies like this, they took very positive action. They worked hard to make sure that in some instances, others who face circumstances like Sandra would be able to bring criminal prosecutions for harassment. So, in fact, there was a new statute passed for these circumstances, although still in Massachusetts, there is no restraining order available, criminal restraining order available. I understand the reasons why, and I understand why. I think in this instance, the legislator responded not in an emotional way by expanding restraining orders for a somewhat unique situation, but responding responsibly for the certain situations where people were stalked, either cyber stalking or telephone or in person, as in this particular case. Case number three, Louise Woodward. Most of the law students probably don't even remember this. It's so old. There was once a British au pair who killed a young baby, 8-month-old Matthew Epen, by slamming his head against either the bathroom floor or wall. We weren't certain which, but he had a fracture in the back of his head. He had a small other fracture. And he had severe brain damage. He had retinal bleeding. By the time he got to the emergency room after she had called 911, he was essentially dead. He was placed on a respirator. The neurosurgeon did surgery on him, but to no avail. His brain was so badly damaged that we knew he would never recover. And the case itself became somewhat of a crazed maelstrom, really, not only in our county but in our Commonwealth and across the country. I was not originally involved with it. I kind of came in at the last minute because my colleague Lynn Rooney, who is going to try the case with Jerry Leone, was actually out on maternity leave. So I came in with Jerry to do the expert witnesses since the case appeared to be taking on a life of its own. The Middlesex courthouse is still wired for any TV trucks that want to come in almost on every floor after that case. It was quite an unusual set of circumstances. For the media, this was an interesting case. If you've read or know of Bonfire of the Vanities, this had some aspects of that. Here is a young 18-year-old girl who's accused of murder. Moreover, she's from Great Britain, and she is a nanny. How unlikely a defendant is this? This can't be true. Maybe the prosecutors have this wrong. They were tenacious in their coverage of this. I think in some respects the coverage created a lot of spin that in some ways undermined the dignity of the family in this particular case. I don't think they were treated the way that the reporters might have liked to be treated. And it was a relentless, before the trial, during and after the trial, a barrage of media about this particular case. And not only do you have all those circumstances, an unlikely defendant, here are these overzealous prosecutors in Middlesex again coming after someone who didn't do anything, but then you have the arrival of Barry Scheck, who had just gotten O.J. Simpson acquitted or had helped. So you have all the ingredients for a really interesting battle in the courtroom in the Middlesex courthouse. Even in the end, Louise Woodward, after she was convicted, was treated as a celebrity. I pulled out some of my old clips from this. British au pair jets home first class. She was still treated as someone who maybe had been misjudged by the system. And indeed, if you recall, the jury had come back and convicted her of second-degree murder, and the judge reduced it to manslaughter and then let her go without any additional time. The Boston Globe, above the fold, Woodward goes home, celebrity story. Underneath, there was a little article that said some articles questioned the premise of the defense theory in this case, but the headline was always Louise Woodward. And the spin on that, at least from our point of view, was always, she couldn't have done this, it doesn't make sense. And interestingly, just one footnote on that trial, as I've been doing child abuse cases for a long time. There was no question in the mind of the doctors who treated this baby. In other cases, we had seen that were not as high profile, that the kinds of injuries this baby had suffered from, the fractured skull, the brain damage, and particularly the retinal bleeding, could only have come from some kind of intentional infliction of harm. And the huge mounting of the defense around this, the experts who came in at $600, $900 an hour, many of whom had no experience in child abuse, in the end did not convince the jury, and they said so. They said, we listened to Louise. We didn't like her or not like her, but it just was irrelevant. The medical evidence was what had convinced us of this. Easier case in some ways than some of the sex abuse cases where it's he said, she said, or in some cases, he said, he said. And so that particular set of circumstances, I mean, I think my co-counsel and I just kept our head down. We didn't read the newspapers. We tried not to get distracted because we knew at that time our goal was to convince those 12 people in the jury who were going to make a decision, and we did, and I still to this day believe we made the right one. In fact, I think since that case there's been a huge sea turn of impressions that after several doctors came to the fore to say that the medical evidence was convincing that this child had been murdered or killed, in this case, a manslaughter conviction. Anybody who had worked with kids or knew about this would know that medical evidence said that. I think there were no, to my knowledge, and I'm somewhat aware of this, there were no successful defenses at trial mounted by these expert witnesses that somehow this baby had suffered from a pre-existing injury that just kind of imploded on him at the last minute. And I think regardless of whether you think it was murder or manslaughter or she should have served more time, the most important thing from my point of view is that people understood that this is how children are hurt and that it perhaps could involve education around preventing it in the future when parents get angry and holding those people accountable who do cause these injuries for children. It just became a case sort of out of case from hell in some respects. And, of course, there were all the issues swirling around it. Why do mothers go to work? And, why are we bringing these nannies overseas? Why aren't we training them? All kinds of sort of collateral issues that came up that people have extremely strong feelings about that influenced the way they felt about it. And I think in some respects the media interest in this and the interest of people who were reading the media were that these issues all came to the forefront and they made no bones about covering them. Let's go to the priest abuse stuff. In 1993, Father Porter was convicted of child rape. He was given a jail sentence. There were civil suits that followed on behalf of several of his victims. And the Archdiocese Commission was established to reform church policy. Never again. I think a lot of people felt that this is a horrific case, but it was one of a kind. It was sui generis. And in fact, in 2002, when the Globe began a spotlight series on the number of pedophile priests and the extent of the archdiocese knowledge, And the Herald was not far behind in that coverage, as well as TV. It was a huge, huge break in this very, in some ways, old-fashioned community. I say that as someone who went to Catholic school. I know the institution. I understood the conflicts that people had about this, but I'd also been a prosecutor and a child abuse prosecutor for a long time. And unlike the Woodward case where we looked at medical evidence, these were trickier. We were looking at children and their disclosure of things that seemed untenable, that seemed couldn't be true. I've always said it's much easier to try a murder case because you have a dead person and you have someone you have to prove did it. In these cases, you have to have proof, you have to convince a jury that people do these things to kids, that it's not the horrible guy in the raincoat who snatched your child, as in the Amber Alert situation, the stranger. We're particularly prepared to respond to that because it doesn't happen that often, and that fits with our worldview. You know, the fairy tales and the always have the dragon breathing fire and the wicked witch with a wart on her nose. But in child abuse, there are no black and white lines like that. The evil person is someone who is in your family, who is the baseball coach, or in this instance, who is the parish priest. And when this story broke, it sent shockwaves through the whole community. Cardinal Law initially believed that he could ride it out. This is a typical headline of the Boston Globe series that went on for several weeks. Scores of priests involved in sex abuse cases. Sounds almost unbelievable. But day after day, the victims were documented, the number of priests were documented, the incidents were documented, the knowledge of the Archdiocese about these events was documented. And slowly, despite what Cardinal Law said initially, that he wouldn't go. In fact, it became, it was in a way, a tsunami wave that did force him to go within several months after that time period because of the extent of the scandal. There was tremendous pressure on the Attorney General Tom Riley and me and the other district attorneys to bring criminal charges against the Archdiocese. How could they let this happen? The public anger at this started to grow and still is there. And as much as we understood that, as much as we looked at case law and statutes in Massachusetts, we knew that there was no real authority for us to bring criminal charges for this kind of criminal liability, at least under Massachusetts law. In these cases, after 2002, we, as many of the district attorney's office, were flooded with victims, who some of whom gone to the Archdiocese, but some who came directly to us, to tell us about the abuse that they had suffered at the hands of priests throughout the Commonwealth. In 2002, we brought indictments against Paul Shanley, Father Gale. There was indictments against Father Paquin from another county, I believe, and charges against Father Hurley. The Father Hurley charges are still pending as we speak. They were all facing charges of child rape. They were facing jail sentences. There were civil suits filed. And guess what? There was a commission established to reform church policy. Sounds a little bit like 7 years ago after the Father Porter case. But what happened in the meantime, I think, was that after Porter, there was this sense that, okay, this got a lot of media attention, but this is one guy. Back in 1995, I tried a case against an individual who was a kid acquitted, and I make it clear that he is still innocent. I'm not suggesting otherwise. The evidence was tricky because the victim who had originally disclosed had recanted. He did not testify, but there was an eyewitness in this case, another priest, and there was forensic evidence in this case. But I think that the prevailing attitudes about who child abusers were made this case very difficult for us to prosecute, and it made it difficult for the jurors to accept it. And it's not by way of being critical, it's just an observation. Many of the jurors agreed to be interviewed afterwards on national TV, and they said that. They found that the evidence was compelling in some respects, but it was just too difficult. They had reasonable doubt. That was fair, but I think that as several of the parishioners came down to court every day who showed support for this individual, the prevailing idea was that here we go again. We've indicted Father Porter, and now it's going to be open season on priests, and these are just overzealous prosecutors trying to make this case. So I just point that case out as an observation that things had changed between 1995 and now 2002. Commonwealth versus John Gagan. Many of you remember that he was convicted in 2002 of one count of indecent assault and battery on a child under 14. He was given a harsh sentence. There's no question about that. He should have been eligible for parole in 9 years, but as many of you probably know, he was murdered while serving his sentence, far beyond the sentence that he should have been given. That started a whole other chain of events in terms of how our criminal justice system handles those who are incarcerated. Another area where I think press and media attention has opened up some fresh air on an area that needs that review. He had originally been put on pretrial probation for minor charges of annoying telephone calls, which was all we could charge him with back in 1993. But we had a wave of cases come forward, most of which were still too old or outside the statute of limitations. And this case in 2002 was the only viable case we had remaining against him. We went forward with it. Prosecutor Lynn Rooney, who was the prosecutor in Paul Shanley, obtained that conviction in what, again, was a difficult case. In 2002, after the Gagin verdict, there were 16 indictments that issued by a grand jury with four victims against Paul Shanley. But by January of 2005, we were down to four indictments with one remaining complaining witness. What had happened in the meantime were several things. For a couple of the victims, going through trial, including a difficult cross-examination, didn't seem to be a viable way they could pursue the case. There was one for whom just coming back to court after a motion to suppress was too difficult, and he literally disappeared. We have since been in touch with him, but we lost touch with him during the time period, and his case had to be nolprost. There was an interesting legal issue that came up during this case, and I draw your attention to it just to point out what I think is the tension that we have between a media that is really trying in some ways to not go over the top, to be respectful of what happens in the criminal justice field, to be fair to victims and to defendants. But it was something we hadn't. Usually I'm dealing with the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment. I spent a couple weeks dealing with the First Amendment, which I hadn't done since I was here at BU Law School. Massachusetts has a statute, 265, Section 24C, that says it's unlawful to publish, disseminate, or otherwise disclose the name of an alleged victim of sex offenses. And it is punishable by a fine. It is a criminal statute. It was true until fairly soon before the case that none of the media in the area were reporting who this remaining victim was, male number three, or showing any of his image. Some of it was that they didn't really know because we'd had four victims. Three of them, in fact, had come forward back in 2002, and some of them may be still familiar to you based upon the civil case. One of them had not, and it was clear the newspapers didn't want to publish his name. But when one started to publish it and a brief order was issued by a judge prior to trial that they could not, it opened up a whole another area because the newspaper's contention was, we will not be subject to a prior restraint here. This is a young man, this male number three, who has been interviewed. He was interviewed by the New York Times. He was interviewed out in Colorado. And he has essentially waived his right to get the protection of this particular statute. After a long discussion and I think considerable review by Judge Neal, I think he reached the right decision. He found that the privacy intent justified by this statute in Massachusetts had essentially been waived by this young man. Interestingly, what happened next was that the order was a prior restraint, and the newspapers and TV quickly said, well, we don't intend to publish his name. There was one outlet that did, but the others really respected his privacy, basically saying we will abide by this voluntary restraint we put on ourselves, but we will not have the court tell us that we cannot publish it, which I think was ultimately the right result. And I will say that I found in dealing with this issue a difficult legal issue that the newspapers, although they fought extremely aggressively to make sure that the prior restraint was not imposed, then were extremely respectful of the victim's privacy. And to this day, we are grateful for that, but more importantly, he is grateful for that. You should know that the judge was aware, and it was true, that at many times, if this young man, for instance, had come and found his paper, his picture and his name above the fold, given where he worked and what was going on, he might not have chosen to come to court. But the newspapers and the press, I think, were considerate of that. With court TV, it's a little bit different. Courts have more control over what they do while they're actually televising, since they don't have to agree to televise a trial. And the court TV actually agreed, as the judge had requested and entered an order, that there be no image of the victim, his wife or father, for identity purposes while they were testifying. And they They did abide by that during the trial, which I think was the one thing that allowed him again to come in and tell his story. Otherwise, we would not have been able to proceed with any conviction or against Paul Shanley. At that stage, this was the only remaining victim in the statute of limitations who could have told what had happened to him in a court of law, criminal court of law. Different statute of limitations, different issues in the civil cases, but in the criminal statutes, and just as a footnote, the only reason that he was still within the statute of limitations is because Paul Shanley had left the Commonwealth and there was a tolling statute that applied. From a law enforcement perspective, some of the good things that came out of the publicity and the public awareness around this archdiocese situation was that there has been legislation filed. It's clearly too late for victims of clergy at this stage because it's not retroactive. You now can face criminal liability in Massachusetts if you are negligent in employing those who abuse children. Clearly would have been an applicable statute had it been in effect at the time, as to the hierarchy who knew about abuse situations and continued to move priests from parish to parish. There is also pending a proposed elimination of the statute. I've got a statute of limitations. That will be subject to some debate. Again, it will not help the current victims, but clearly people are concerned about what happened and want to make sure that it won't happen again. The one thing that has happened that I think will make a huge difference is that although this entire institution was exempt from mandated reporting and there was no internal policing, that won't happen. The mandated reporting law was changed in Massachusetts. I'd like to think that this kind of situation, again, which I believe was really only uncovered by the results of the investigative reporting by the media in Boston and then the civil suits brought by their plaintiffs' attorneys, I believe we would not have had those criminal cases without that groundwork, that education and mandated reporting will ensure that this kind of what I've called the perfect storm of child abuse, authority figures having unlimited access to children who are afraid to tell, and if they told, no one might believe them, should not, and I hope will not happen again. A couple of brief conclusions, and I actually have a quick postscript. I just want to make one other note before I do this. I see my friend Victor Garrow is in the audience today, and there's one other case I can think of where I think the media coverage of the way a defendant was wrongfully convicted, Joe Salvati, had a huge impact on many of us in the law profession, including myself. And I've told Victor this. I changed my opinion on the death penalty as a result of that particular case. And the reporting by Dan Ray, another BU law school graduate, and Victor's work over years, I think started to bring to light the idea that there were people sitting in prison who shouldn't be there. In that case, particularly where there was misconduct by government officials is egregious. And as we've seen recently, because we've had some in our county where we, by DNA results, have filed null process because witnesses, eyewitnesses have made mistakes. It's a sobering experience to realize that an indictment and a conviction to the death penalty, we can never be certain that we are right. And although we keep people in jail, I believe we should be able to review those convictions because those cases have shown us that we make mistakes. Certainly, I don't believe in the near future that police and prosecutors are going to be put out of business. I think there's plenty of crime that will still happen, and there are criminals who are unpredictable who will be violent. We're not going to change that. But I do believe that law enforcement, social services, medicine, legislators, and public health need to look at facts, in particular patterns of cases, such as child abuse or, as I mentioned earlier, an epidemic of prescription drug abuse, and they need to work together with the media to make education available so that we can change statutes, that we can educate those who might prevent those crimes and protect those individuals from further abuse. We depend upon the media to, in an accurate and timely way, to keep us honest, I think, as public officials, as those who prosecute, I think it does and should keep us on our toes. I think we're accountable for what we do. I think we have to answer for the indictments and the convictions we seek. And if we're wrong, I think we have to acknowledge that. I think we have an obligation to keep the population informed, and the media does that. I think that is the way in which the public these days can be inspired and will motivate changes. In the end, Sergeant Joe Friday said, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts, but we know that's not really enough. And the media has a huge role and an important role to play in making sure that they balance with us the First Amendment, with us in the courts, of course, we're the final arbiters of that, to make sure that defendants receive a fair trial. I show you the two examples of Paul Shanley and Louise Woodward to indicate, depending upon the particular spin, one side or the other may have not got into an even playing field before the trial. But I think it's equally important that those victims and witnesses have a level playing field, because after all, we do believe in trial by jurors, trial by peer, and not trial by media. And so we will deal with a situation case by case to make sure that all of those interests are balanced. Good news for the budding lawyers in the office, there will still be plenty of work for everybody to do, and these are important and interesting issues regardless of which angle you approach them from. And they need thoughtful application. There's no easy way to say in any given case how we're going to apply the First Amendment rights, what statutes are prior restraints. There was a challenge, by the way, to that Massachusetts statute as being a prior restraint. But for now, that will remain unresolved by the courts because media still have voluntarily agreed not to publish names of sex abuse victims. I want to add a few postscripts to this because it seems to me that after not much activity on this front recently, there has been a great deal of courtroom activity around newspapers and libel issues. Just recently, there was a jury in our county that ruled that a Stoneham realtor had not been libeled by a spotlight series conducted by some of the same reporters who were involved in the church archdiocese reporting. But also just recently, our Supreme Judicial Court affirmed that the Globe had libeled a doctor in a series about the death of Betsy Lehman, who had been at Dana-Farber and had died from a chemotherapy mistake overdose. And although the SJC had reduced the verdict, they upheld it. And it's interesting to note that the Globe, as a practical matter, had no defense to it because they refused to reveal their sources. In December, a federal judge sentenced a Providence TV reporter to 6 months home confinement because he wouldn't reveal who gave him an FBI surveillance tape. All of the interests that we've talked about are extremely important ones, and the ways in which we try and resolve the balance to ensure, again, a free press and a fair trial and the rights of victims and witnesses will continue to be something that I hope will be done in a thoughtful way, will be done in a respectful way, and for the lawyers in the audience, probably will be decided by lawyers.
You've been listening to a lecture by Massachusetts Middlesex County District Attorney Martha Coakley, entitled Media Coverage of Criminal Cases, What is the Responsibility of the Fourth Estate? We began with an introduction by School of Law Dean Ad Interim Maureen O'Rourke. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skoog and Matt Odette, with help from Vince Fairchild. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.